Hello, I'm Katrine De Volder. This is the Practical Ethics Channel. So this is the audio version of an interview I conducted with Julian Savulescu, Professor of Practical Ethics at the University of Oxford and Director of the Oxford Hero Center for Practical Ethics. I interviewed Julian on the ethics of genetic selection and human enhancement. And this was at a public engagement event organized by De Maakbare Mens, which is a Belgian non-profit organization facilitating public debates on various topics related to the so-called makeability of humans. So we'd like to thank De Maakbare Mens for the audio files of this interview and Bram Munster for the photos.
Professor Julian Savulescu.
First of all, thanks so much for being here. So I realize very well how busy your schedule is. So I think we should all be grateful for having you here. So thanks very much. So Julian made valuable contributions to almost any debate in bioethics, So he has worked on the ethics of infectious disease, like how can we prevent growing danger of antibiotics resistance. He's worked on end-of-life issues, euthanasia, animal ethics, like the ethics of animal experimentation, and so on. But I think it's fairly uncontroversial to say that you've caused most controversy with your contributions to the debate about genetic selection and human enhancement. I think you've probably made a few people angry even. So it's great that you'll have a chance to sort of explain your views a bit to us. Okay, so when we think about genetic selection, there are two important questions. So a first question is genetic selection acceptable? So genetic selection in general. So is it ever acceptable to use genetic selection? The second question is, if it is acceptable to do genetic selection sometimes in some circumstances, how should we decide what children to choose? How should we select? And that's what we want to, I would like to focus on today, because I think that's the interesting question. So, Julian, you have developed a famous, or should I say infamous, principle to help us decide what children to select. And it's called procreative beneficence, and basically it means that parents or individuals or people who want to have a child should choose the child from among different children they could have. They should choose the child that will have the best chance at the best life. So why should we choose the child that we think will have the best life?
Katrin said that my view is controversial, but in fact it's common sense. And I want to give you an example where I think that you will agree with me, that is a kind of clear example of this principle. So not only do I think people should be allowed to do this, but that they should do it. And by should, I mean they have a reason that can be outweighed by other reasons, but that if there are no other reasons, they should do it. So here's an example. So some of you may have heard of this Zika virus, which is passed by mosquitoes to human beings. And it doesn't affect people like you, but if you're trying to have a child, it can cause the child to have a small brain and intellectual disability. One way to, there's no treatment for it, but one way to avoid this is to avoid getting Zika. But sometimes you don't know if you've been infected, and it can take 3 months to tell whether you've actually had the infection. So when the epidemic was at its peak in South America, for example, in countries like Brazil, Public Health England, the medical authority, said, it issued a warning to people, and it said, if you are thinking about having a child and you've been to an area with Zika, you should wait 3 months before you start to try to conceive to have a child. And the reason is, if you conceive now, you might be infected with Zika still from coming back from Brazil. Now, the child that you will have in 3 months will be a different egg. There will have been at least 2 cycles and a different sperm because sperm turn over. So the child that you will have in 3 months will be a different child than the child you would have had today. In fact, it might be of the opposite sex. So the child that you have in 3 months might be healthy Harry, whereas the child that you would have today, if you were infected with Zika, will be maybe Zelda with microcephaly and intellectual disability. So what Public Health England says is you should have healthy Harry rather than Zelda with intellectual disability. That's what you should do. And if you went to a doctor and asked their advice, you would expect the doctor to say, you should wait 3 months. Now, I have asthma, so I'm an asthmatic. If the doctor, and I went to the doctor and said, look, doctor, I'm thinking of having a child. The doctor said, look, we've got this new pill, and if you and your wife take it for 3 months, the child that you'll have in 3 months' time won't have asthma. I'd take the pill and wait 3 months, but that will be a different child. That's like having 2 embryos and you do tests on them and you predict one will have asthma and one won't. That indicates that not only should we select against conditions like intellectual disability, but also minor conditions like asthma. Or to take another example, which is more controversial. If I went to the doctor and said, look, doctor, I'm thinking of trying to have a child. The doctor says, look, if you take this pill for three months, and then try to conceive, your child will have a higher IQ. I'll guarantee you the child will have an IQ over 120 and be able to go to university, whereas who knows what will happen if you have a child now. I'd wait 3 months. Why? Because it's better to be able to go to university than not. You have a wider range of options and choices. So procreative beneficence is something that guides our medical advice, but also I think guides what would be our everyday practices if we reflected on them more.
So it's good that you mentioned IQ. So there is this company in the US, Genome Prediction, who claims that they'll be able to predict, or that they'll be able to help people select the embryo, an embryo with a very high IQ. But so then we'd have to be pretty sure that IQ actually contributes to a good life. But how can we be sure about that? I mean, IQ aren't smart, very smart people, also often a bit depressed just because they are so smart. So how do we know what traits will contribute to well-being?
So I think Genomic Prediction at the moment is only offering tests, but they are offering tests for identifying low normal intelligence, not very high IQ, but just IQ, which is normal, but the normal level is between 70 and 130. And less than 70 is intellectual disability. And they're offering tests that will give you a higher probability that an embryo will be somewhere in the lower range between 70 and 85. So is that a good thing? Well, we need to do scientific research and try to understand what are the benefits and disadvantages of having something like IQ or impulse control or whatever property you think that you might want to select. Now, as it happens, there is a lot of research on IQ. And what that research shows is that IQ is roughly 50% genetic. Using the sorts of research that that's being used in this test, you could probably identify up to half of that 50%. But that still means you'll be able to make predictions. So is it better to have, you know, a higher or a lower IQ? There is no evidence that higher IQ makes people less happy. Having a low IQ means that you'll have a lower range of job opportunities. You'll have to be in more supervised lower paid jobs, you're more likely to be murdered, you're more likely to become ill, and you're more likely to be lower on the socioeconomic scale. Even having a very, very high IQ, it's still worth increasing it. So if you think about patents as a measure, the ability to produce a patent means you've invented something that's useful to society. If you look at the top 1% of IQ, they produce more patents than the average. But even within that top 1%, the bottom quarter produces 3.5 times as many patents as the average.
Patents, yeah.
The top one quarter of that top 1% produces about 8 times as many patents. So even increasing your IQ, if you're in the top 1%, will mean that you'll be able to produce more patents. So, I mean, this is just a sketch. I'm going to try to provoke you to, because I think ethics is about getting you to think. I don't really care whether you're in favour of enhancement or not, personally, or whether society legalises. I think it's good to think about it for yourself. But I think, and I can only sketch a bit of the evidence, but clearly it depends on what the evidence is. But the evidence as I see it is very important for the individual, but it's even equally important for society. So when we used lead in petrol and paint, it would reduce people's IQ by affecting children's brain development. And when we got rid of lead from petrol and paint, people's IQ rose. This is called lead abatement. Based on those studies, experts have estimated that just a 3% increase in everyone's IQ would add 1.5% to GDP, $150 billion to the US economy, reduce poverty by 25% and welfare recipiency by 18% and males in jail by 18%. Massive effects. So the US military, who don't have the sort of kind of restrictions that we have in civil society, the research arm of the US military has said even a small increase in the working population's IQ would have the same economic effects as the introduction of the internet. So as far as I understand the evidence, it's good for the individual and it's good for society. And that's why if somebody told me that doing something would enable my child to have a higher IQ, I would do it. And that's why I send my children to school, because school is a cognitive enhancer. It actually increases IQ. And that's why school is compulsory, because it's a beneficial effect.
Okay, so intelligence is one trait, but I want to zoom in a bit more on what you mean by the best chance at the best life. So the best life is a life containing much well-being. So does that mean we should create happy people? And does that mean that, for example, there is a reason to select for children with, for example, Down syndrome? Because, I mean, I don't know much about it, but some people say they have a cheerful disposition and are quite happy, so.
Well, I think one of the most urgent questions facing society is what is a good life? So countries like Bhutan have moved from gross domestic product and economic markers of success of a country to the gross happiness index. So they follow a Buddhist tradition and say that what matters is happiness. And that's what we should be aiming for as a marker of success of our country and of individual lives. And happiness is certainly important. But if you think about your own life, well, at least when I think about my own life, happiness is not the only thing I want. I want happiness, but I also want certain things that I think are good to have as a human being, like a rich and deep set of relationships, friends and family, children. I want to be able to develop my talents. I entered this field of philosophy. I used to do medicine because I thought it would be more creative. I want to understand the world and myself. I want to improve. I want to engage with nature. I don't want to age. All of these things, some philosophers have said, are objective goods. So I think, personally, I think well-being is a mixture of happiness and these other kinds of goods. So why is IQ important? It's important to help you gain what are called rational beliefs, beliefs that are more likely to be true about the world or yourself based on the information that you have available. It's the ability to draw inferences. So I think that's a valuable property. Whether or not it makes you happy, it enables you to gain a better understanding of yourself. I also think autonomy is important, being able to set your own goals and live your own life according to what you think is best. So I think those three things, autonomy, happiness, and these objective properties. But this is hugely contested. For 2,000 years, philosophers have debated this. But we have to start to answer the question, because is it good for children, like my children, to spend hours on social media, even if they want to? You have to have a yardstick to measure what it's doing. So the challenge of deciding whether this or that embryo is going to have a better chance of a better life is an important question, but it's also an important question for all of us.
But doesn't that make it a bit too difficult for people who want to have a child? Doesn't that give them too much responsibility to try to think which of the possible children I could create will have the best chance at the best life? I mean, it's already very difficult to decide about what school you'll send your child to. That can already be very difficult. So I'll say
two things. With power comes responsibility. So as soon as you can change the course of events, unfortunately, you become responsible for the outcome, even if you choose nothing. Because choosing nothing, when you can avoid that outcome and knowing that there's another option with another set of possible outcomes, is to actively be choosing that. So unfortunately, we can't avoid the responsibility that we have. But it might sound very onerous to be searching through thousands of embryos to work out which one precisely is going to be. And for many people, it simply won't arise because they have a child in the normal way, they become pregnant, and they don't want to give up their pregnancy for the sake of, a few IQ points, possible gain. They will only have a termination of pregnancy for something they judge to be very significant, like Zika. But when you're already having IVF and you produce 10 embryos, we now have this ability to sequence the whole genome. And I think you've heard talks already where doctors are searching that genome for diseases, and that's a wonderful thing in my view. But if there are also combinations of genes that are associated with either better or worse lives, in my view, we should treat them in exactly the same way as we treat diseases, because disease is not something that is a category difference. It blends into normality. Intellectual disability blends into normal IQ. Psychopathy blends into hard-headedness. So many of the properties that we call diseases are actually just extreme ends of something that, has degrees. And what matters to us is how our lives go, and we should make a decision about whether those properties are going to make for better.
So do you think it's the parents who have to decide about what they think will give their child a good life or the best possible life? And if so, what do you think about cases where, these are real cases, where deaf couples have used genetic technologies to choose a deaf child? Because on their view, deafness is not a disability. A child that is deaf, they say, will have a life as good as any hearing children. Deafness is more like deaf people are more like a minority group, comparable to black people or women.
A minority group.
Minority group is women. I was going to say a group that is. Okay, that was a mistake. I was thinking of where the disadvantage that comes to you is sort of mainly caused by society, and that was more the comparison between women and deaf people, where deaf people say, well, the disadvantage that we have is just because society is not sort of adapting well enough to.
Yeah. Some deaf people say that deafness is a culture and it's a difference, not a disability, that the disadvantages that deaf deaf people face are the result of the way society is constructed. So that, you know, if we all were able to sign, or society wasn't constructed in a way that was based on, you know, speech and oral signals, they would have as good a lives as anyone else. And I agree with that to a large degree, that there are four ways in which you can improve human well-being. You can change the natural environment, you can change society, you can change psychology, or you can change biology. And it's certainly true that that deaf people have very good lives, and that their lives could be even better if society were reorganised. But even if society were maximally reorganised, we could not eliminate all of the disadvantages of deafness. So you won't be able to respond to auditory warnings or auditory threats. And it's simply, we don't have the resources to completely reconfigure society in a way that it completely eliminates all of those disadvantages at the moment. If we did, it would be no disadvantage at all. And I think being hearing for a child of a deaf couple is like being able to be bilingual or be a part of two societies. The hearing child can be both a part of the deaf culture and learn to sign, but also be able to hear and speak. So I think deafness has some disadvantage, less than we think, but still some. Now, we face this crisis of ethics where up until now we've been able to get away with what's called liberal neutrality, saying we're neutral to what people think is good for themselves. And really it's relative to what they think or what their culture thinks. But unfortunately now we have to make decisions. So if a deaf couple comes and says to a doctor, we want you to deafen our child. The child can hear, but we want the child to be a part of our culture and we want you to cut the auditory nerves. Or if they have a deaf child where there is a cure for the deafness that has to be done now, like a cochlear implant, and they say, we don't want to use the cochlear implant because we think that deafness is just a difference. Now you have to make a decision. Is it really just a difference like having a different hair colour or being a different sex? Or is there something that is really going to be a disadvantage for that child to some degree, and we should correct that disadvantage? And I think it is. I don't think that people should be allowed to deafen their child or refuse interventions that will give that child hearing. Now, when it comes to selection, I think it's slightly different. Because let's just go back to my Zika example. Imagine that a couple have a virus that, if they conceive a child now, so rubella is like this, German measles. Imagine that a woman has German measles and she says, look, I want to have a child. And the doctor says, look, if you have a child now, the child's going to be deaf. But if you wait 3 months, the child will be able to hear. If she has a child now, she'll have one deaf child. If she waits 3 months, she'll have a hearing child that's different. Now, if she has the child now, she hasn't harmed that child because that child won't exist. That's different to taking a child who can hear now and cutting the auditory nerves. So I think selection is wrong for a disability, but I think it should be allowed. I think people should be free to do that because it's a different kind of way of having a deaf child. It's a complicated point, but I think shows that philosophy is necessary to really carve up these cases more finely.
So, I mean, if we sort of form ideas of what type of children should exist and shouldn't exist, if it's not completely up to the parents in a sense, aren't we sort of at risk of sliding down the path to dangerous forms of eugenics? So if you think of eugenics, I mean, people think of what the Nazis did, forced sterilization of certain groups, even killing people that were thought to have inferior genes. Think of progressives in the US in the early 20th century. In the US in the early 20th century, there were many states that had laws that saying that it was allowed to forcibly sterilize certain groups of people, like the mentally retarded or the blind, the deaf, Native Americans and African Americans, because they were thought to have inferior genes. So these were also people that had good things in mind. They wanted to improve genes in the human gene pool, but it ended up with really horrible practices. So isn't what you are promoting too close to this sort of scenario?
Well, the word eugenics comes from the Greek meaning well-born, and it means choosing better children, having the next generation better than the previous generation. And clinical genetics is a form of eugenics. It's enabling people to be born without diseases. So Down syndrome screening is a form of eugenics that's practiced now. The difference between modern eugenics, which is sometimes called liberal eugenics, and Nazi eugenics, or the eugenics of the 19th and 20th century, because it wasn't only the Nazis, it was practiced in Sweden and the US and many, many parts of Europe, is that, as you correctly said, Nazi eugenics was involuntary. People were forced to have terminations of pregnancy or forced to be sterilised. And it wasn't aimed at having a child with a better chance of a better life for the child. It was aimed at realising racist, social Darwinist ideals about how society should be. Now, modern eugenics is about offering parents the opportunity to choose and the freedom to say no. So 10% of people choose not to terminate pregnancies with Down syndrome. And they're absolutely free to do that, and that freedom should be protected. People are free not to have screening for deafness, and I think they should even be free to select embryos that have either Down syndrome or deafness. So modern eugenics is very different. But would we think that parents are free to cause intellectual disability to their child, say by shaking a baby or hitting a child over the head, causing a similar level of intellectual disability as that would be associated with Zika or even Down syndrome? Or say there was a cure now for cystic fibrosis or for Down syndrome, a pill that you could give in the early months of life. Would we think then parents should be able to decide not to give that pill? It's like a Jehovah's Witness saying, I'm not going to give my child a blood transfusion because I believe that the Bible forbids taking blood, and if we don't take blood, we'll go to heaven. It's entirely reasonable for adults to decide to not have a blood transfusion and die for their religious beliefs. But I don't believe that parents should be able to refuse life-saving blood transfusions, and I don't believe we should be able to refuse treatments for major medical conditions or even minor conditions that are going to help the child later in life.
So I fully agree that eugenics today is very different from eugenics in the past, and there is no coercion involved. But some people are concerned that there is still quite a lot of pressure on people to do a lot of tests. And for example, in Belgium, there was quite a bit of controversy because the government made sure that the NIPT test, NIPT test, the non-invasive prenatal diagnosis test.
You might tell them.
Yeah, I'll tell in a minute. Could be, I think, largely it's like you could refund it. So it's very cheap for people in Belgium to have this test. So it's the blood test. This is gewoon de, this is een genetische test van de foetus. Dus zowel de vrouw zwanger is, maar dat kan gewoon gedaan worden via een heel simpele bloedtest, omdat er een beetje DNA van de foetus in het bloed van de vrouw is. Dus het is eigenlijk heel eenvoudig om die test te doen, heel goedkoop en zo. Hier, zeker in België, in Engeland, kost het £600. So many people thought that the government making this test so cheap actually thereby sort of put some kind of pressure on people to have yourself tested, and that they were worried that this would result in fewer cases, fewer children with Down syndrome. So people were concerned that there would be fewer children with Down syndrome. I don't think it was the case, but it's difficult to know what the effect was of the policy. But yeah. So So my question is, I mean, is there a reason to be concerned about this sort of pressure that can be created by policies?
Well, one concern is that it will create a pressure, and indeed people have, you know, quite inappropriately been criticised for not using these screening tests. It may reduce the number of people with that condition and so the social support services for people. And it may be seen to be expressing a view about the value of people's lives with those conditions. So another common criticism is that promoting screening for Down syndrome expresses a negative view about people's lives who have Down syndrome. And I think all three of those are problems, and those are problems that need to be addressed. So, for example, we should be putting more money into supporting and including people of a diverse range of features because they're people. And somebody who has Down syndrome or intellectual disability or asthma or some other feature that makes their life in society more difficult should be given a fair go. And I think it's a mistake to equate people with some feature about themselves, like equating me with my asthma or equating somebody with Down syndrome as being somehow identical with Down syndrome. They're a person. Their name might be John, just like my name's Julian. They'll have friends, they'll have interests, they'll have a life that... And so I think we need to move away from this reduction of people to their disabilities or features about themselves. And this also applies in the sort of transgender debate. So I think we need to correct that reduction. We need to ensure that people are given a fair go. And we need to ensure that they're not forced into choices, because freedom is only real if people have a real choice. And that doesn't just mean a choice on paper. It means the real opportunity to choose the option that other people might disagree with. So that means not just supporting their choices, but enabling them to have the mental environment to make those choices freely. So I agree those are real adverse effects of promoting screening, but I don't think the response to it is we should ban Down syndrome screening or we should discourage Down syndrome screening by making it expensive. And what we should be doing is looking at those problems, which are separate to giving people the choice about something that is very important.
Okay, now I just want to move on to some to discussion about enhancements. So I'm thinking about the gene editing experiments that were recently done in China that have were mentioned earlier today, I think. So scientists genetically modifying genes in the embryo to ensure that the children that would develop from these embryos would be resistant to HIV, the virus causing AIDS. So this is a form of enhancement. These children would not have been ill, they would not have had AIDS. It's just making them resistant to AIDS. So do you think these experiments are a good thing?
So those experiments I described as monstrous, but I think they were unethical and shouldn't have been done. And the reason for that is that the scientist Jianghui, he or he, I think it's pronounced in Chinese, but I don't speak Chinese, took normal embryos with a normal chance of a normal life, a good chance of a good life, and gave them or attempted to give them resistance to HIV, which can be prevented in many ways by not having sex with people with HIV, by not sharing needles, by not engaging in risky practices, and it can be treated. So it didn't provide a necessary benefit, and it also exposed them to risks, because gene editing is a very immature technology that can cause damage to the DNA in other areas and maybe cause cancer. So I think it was wrong to expose those children to a risk for no real benefit. However, if he'd done the gene editing experiment with an embryo with a condition that was lethal very early in life, say in the first few months of life or even just the first few years, attempting to cure that condition. So one genetic condition that's common in the Jewish population is Tay-Sachs disease. If you took an embryo with Tay-Sachs disease, where that child would only survive a few years, the benefits are very great, and the risk, if, for example, the gene editing were to result in the premature death, would be a much smaller loss to that individual. So I think this sort of research is important at some point, because what it's doing is trying to develop cures for genetic conditions. And this is a kind of ultimate form of medicine. Instead of trying to give a drug that replaces the missing protein that is the result of a genetic disorder, they're trying to go back and correct the gene itself so the body can produce that protein in every cell. So I think this kind of research is very important, but it should start with embryos that essentially have nothing to lose, instead of human beings with everything to lose.
But you think that in principle, I mean, you don't have any objections in principle to gene editing embryos, even if it's for enhancement purposes, if the technology were safe?
Well, I mean, think about it. If there were a vaccination for HIV that was completely safe and had no side effects, I would fall over myself to get it. That's what medicine is about. Now, if that, instead of being a vaccination, were a modification of a gene and it had no side effects, I would fall over myself to get it and also to give it to my children. The only difference between routine vaccination and gene editing is the risks. The outcome is the same. So, you know, genes, people have this kind of mystery about genes. Genes just make proteins, and proteins contribute to who we are, but they are not who we are. There's nothing special about genes, except that at the moment, our understanding of them is very limited, and our ability to intervene safely is very limited. But were it the science to progress, there's no difference between giving a drug and correcting a gene so that the body itself produces the same molecule that you were going to give, you know, externally. So to take one example, there's a disease called Gaucher's disease, where an enzyme isn't produced and it causes brain and liver damage. Now, researchers have been able to replace that enzyme and essentially cure this disease, but it's really expensive. It costs £180,000, I mean over 200,000 euros a year per patient to treat. So in the UK, it costs over £20 million. Gene editing would be very cheap. And what gene editing would do would be correct that gene so the body produces the enzyme it was supposed to produce every day for the rest of that individual's life, instead of having to give a drug every day. And gene editing probably costs about £5,000. So it's, as a treatment for disease, it's really irresistible once it becomes safe enough.
So one difference, of course, is if you gene edit very early embryos, the changes that you make will be passed on to future generations.
So one of the principles of practical ethics is you want to compare the intervention you're discussing not with some Hollywood romantic fantasy of the way you think the world should be, but with actually reality. I'll give you a whole range of things that change the DNA that's passed on to the next generation. Smoking. Having a child when you're older. Viruses. Getting a virus. All of these things change our DNA and they're passed on to the next generation. Now, it's true that when you do a gene edit at the stage of an embryo, it will be passed on to the next generation. And that means that next generation is exposed to risks. That just increases the stakes. It also increases the benefits, because if you're talking about correcting a gene that is abnormal, that would be passed on to the next generation, now it won't be passed on to the next generation. So there's nothing, first of all, unusual about changing genes that are passed on to the next generation, and there's nothing special about it in kind. It just changes the magnitude of the risks and benefits that means you have to do more scientific research before you do it. But there's no absolute line to do it, to doing it, in my view.
So a question about how it could be used in society. I mean, is there a risk that it would increase inequality in society, that gene editing in embryos would be something that is used by the rich, and that this would sort of result in a genetic upper class of intelligent, attractive, healthy people because they had access to these technologies, and then poor people just don't have access to these technologies, exacerbating sort of the socio-economical splits between the two groups?
All right, let's take one example that is close to my heart. Aging is completely normal. And it's also one of the targets of enhancement. And in non-human animals, there have been mice that have been genetically engineered to live twice as long as normal mice. So let's assume, and what Katrin is talking about is not correction of a single gene, but maybe modifying 50 genes, which has already been done in non-human animals, and modifying them so that people don't age. They maybe live to 120 with a healthy life and full capacity until they're 120. This is called health span, increasing health span. In my view, that would be a fantastic enhancement. It would raise huge social questions and questions about the number of people there should be in the world, so it will raise other questions. But in itself, I think it would be benefit for that individual, at least if a sufficient number of other individuals did it. So we can imagine a world where this is expensive, and not only do the rich have cosmetic surgery and sort of look younger, they actually are younger. They're younger because they've had their genes modified and they're not aging. And then the poor, like me, age and sort of lose their capacities and look at these kind of healthy, vibrant, productive, functioning centenarians. That would be bad. It's just like it's bad that the rich buy better healthcare or better education. And in my view, if it's important, it should be made available through the public health system. And everyone gets access to it. But it's even more important than that, because at the moment, there are some people who get to 100 in really good shape. And it's genetic. They're lucky. Nature allots every property about us unequally. The mere fact that you're here, you know, on a Saturday afternoon, you know, at this means that you're probably pretty financially and biologically privileged. There are a lot of people who aren't that well off, and gene editing can correct that. So gene editing could give those of us who don't age as well as the centenarians an equal chance of having the best things that life can offer. And science is giving us, you know, the power to do these things, and I think we should have the ethical framework to do them in a way that creates the sort of lives that and the sort of society that we think we ought to create. And I think greater equality could also be the outcome, as well as greater inequality.
Thanks for that. I would like to invite some of the previous speakers to ask a question. It's very dark for me, so I can't really see where they are. But if there's any of the previous speakers who would like to ask a question. I was looking for you, but I couldn't. It's dark. So.
Yes, I thought you'd have some questions.
The thing is, of course, you can say there will be this pill that will give me the perfectly intelligent baby. From a today's genetic standpoint, we know that we don't have this enhanced yet. You mentioned 50 genes, and I agree with you. There may be situations where, say, in 10 years from now, we will have a better grasp on this thing. But aren't you applying rules and examples that are suitable to black and white situations now to your kind of inclining or declining field? Can you say that something which is treated now because it's black and white, the Zika kit, compare it to something which will always be gray, and that your principles seem to be the same that apply for those two situations. Can you apply the same rules ethically or philosophically to things which are less tangible than others?
Yeah, look, I think that's a great, I'm glad you asked that. We didn't actually organize this. But I think that's a really important point. Sometimes people come to me and say, look, Julian, you know, it's very simple in these sort of cases that you're describing, but actually genes don't work like that. The genes that will dispose to manic depression will also be associated with creativity. The genes that are associated with autism spectrum disorders, at least in the Asperger's range, are associated with abilities in science, technology, engineering, mathematics. There'll be introversion has advantages and disadvantages. Extroversion has different advantages. How do we know what's better? I absolutely agree. There'll be much grey, as you've said. It won't be clear whether it's better or worse to have that constellation of genes. Maybe in that case we don't allow selection. We don't allow enhance, and we just allow parents to choose which of them whether they want to have the embryo which has got a higher chance of having a mental disorder, but perhaps having a higher chance of a creative life, or one that's got a less interesting life but is mentally healthier. That's a grey question, but that shouldn't stop us from looking for the black and the white. And maybe there won't be much black and white once you get outside of disease, because disease is just something where we're really clear that thing. But even now we're getting pressure where people say, well, maybe deafness isn't a disease or disability. I think that we have to search for the black and the white, but also acknowledge that there's grey and there might be a lot of grey. And how far we'll go, we don't know, because we haven't done the science and we also haven't done the ethics. We haven't done we haven't set the values that we're trying to achieve properly. We haven't really thought through what we should be aiming for. But you know, I think the jury's out, and you know, I think it's a project that, you know, I think has got legs, because I just think as a matter of observation, you know, inequality is quite profound. And not all of that inequality is social. Socially determined. Some of it has a biological contribution. Now, I could be wrong about that. We just really don't know at the moment, because this has only really started in the last, you know, these you know, what are called GWAS, huge studies of hundreds of thousands or millions of people and genetics is just really starting. And that's what's kicked off. Until a few years ago, there were no genes for intelligence. There was nothing. And then they started these GWAS studies, and the problem was they couldn't get large enough because they didn't have IQ scores. So what they did was they used educational attainment as a proxy that correlates, and that was found. And because you could get hundreds of thousands of people, they suddenly started to account for, you know, 5, 10, 15, now up to 15% of, you know, the genetic contribution to intelligence. And they think they can get to 30, but not 50 without new methods. So I think we're starting to make progress. That's only been in the last 2 or 3 years. So I think it's really too early to say whether it's just all grey.
Yeah, but maybe then we should explain to people, if they allow me to tell about this GWAS. So what happens in GWAS studies is people look at disease patients or intelligent people and less intelligent people, and then they look at the frequency, as we call it, of variation. And then people say, okay, we see that, for instance, one gene, the variant is more frequent in disease, but it's about proportions. So statistically, it can be very strong, and you can say we have found that variant more often. But because the variant exists in both groups, you cannot reverse the inference. You cannot say, well, now I have, say that you have black balls here, but you have less black than you have yellow. And here you have, oh, you said national colors. And then on the other one, you have statistically significantly more black rather than yellow. But if I would give you a black one, you can't tell me on which side of these two groups that black person would be, or that black ball would be. It's not a person. You see what I mean? So yeah, you can't reverse it. And this is a mistake that is being made when people interpret this kind of GWAS studies.
And so another area that kind of throws the sort of questions up, is the genetic modification of non-human animals. We don't have genetically modified human beings. We have billions of dollars and massive, you know, experiments modifying characteristics in non-human animals. In fact, one sort of, you know, example you'll be familiar with, the greatest genetic experiment ever done, is the breeding of dogs over 10,000 years. That's a genetic experiment of genetic selection that breeds certain properties. So when it comes to non-human animals, you're able to create striking differences. And, you know, from a biological point of view, we aren't very different from our cousins. And what is possible in, you know, non-human animals is possible in humans. So to take one example, I've got a book coming out, I'll plug it, in January, Love Drugs, about biologically modifying love. And you might say, Savulescu, that's crazy. Love, in the sense I'm using it, has three phases: lust, attraction, attachment. We have the same phases as all other mammals. Love is one of the most highly biologically coded behaviours that creates the propagation of the species through reproduction. Each of those three, lust is sexual desire for a quasi-appropriate mate. Attraction is falling in obsessively attracted to features of that individual. And then attachment is a long-term pair bond that that enables us to bring up our offspring. Each of those has different biological bases. You can modify the biological bases of all three of them. You can create lust by giving testosterone, or in women, flibanserin. Oxytocin promotes bonding. You can change the mating patterns of non-human animals by fiddling with the oxytocin vasopressor receptor system, the third part. So you can create a monogamous foal where previously they were polygamous. And that system has also been, you know, implicated in human attachment. And there are genetic variants, the AVPR1A polymorphism, the 331 polymorphism. There's some association with instability of relationships. Very immature science, but in principle, what has been done with non-human animals could be done with humans. What's your view about that?
What's my opinion? So I explained
so,
about.
So hang on, just so if you want your husband or wife to be faithful, you'll be able to.
That's right, and one can use oxytocin sprays, and yeah. Apparently people look you more often in the eyes if you have these things. My opinion is still that it's a very multifactorial. It's not a disease making love, but it's a very multifactorial thing. And again, how would you select on the genetic level? Would you, okay, you can say I select against polygamy, I select in favor of whatever, but socially, would you try and change it the way you say it? Would you look, ask you know, parents to take a look at how children will love?
I mean, this is just all really at the very beginning. We're at the beginning of what I've called rational evolution, of changing our biology, not just to survive long enough to reproduce, which is how it's been going, but according to our values. And, you know, how would you use it? You're exactly right. It's multifactorial. There are going to be lots of different influences. But I'm pretty sure that this is going to be an important part of our future, and it won't just be about disease. I'll give you another example. So, should I finish? Okay. Well, so there's another gene, okay, another one, Mayo High and Low. This is a gene where if you've got the one-third of you have the low variant, two-thirds have the high variant. The low variant is fine as long as you're not abused or neglected as a child, and then you're more likely to become a criminal or violent or aggressive. I mean, again, if you won't like this, but if I were having IVF and I had 10 embryos, they're all healthy, and then, you know, the doctor comes and says, we can tell you the Mayo A status. Do you want to know it? Yeah, I want to know it. I'll choose the high embryo. Not because I'm going to abuse my child. It's just because unless you can show me an upside to having the low variant, that child might end up in an environment where they're abused or neglected without, you know, outside of my control. So there will be, you know, ways in which, or you could use that to test children who are in deprived environments to see which is more vulnerable. Or you could use it. Now, I don't think that study is, that research is mature enough to use in the ways that I'm describing. But if it were replicated and developed, we may well be using biomarkers to allocate resources, to identify people at risk, or even to select which children we have.
I agree, we will do the same for cancer risk anyways.
Okay, thanks so much, Julian, for this provocative discussion. And
we,
thanks.
We agree on some things.
You agree on some things. Maybe some extra oxytocin will make the bond a bit stronger. So thanks very much for this piece. Let's give Julian a big applause.
Thanks very much for listening to this interview. If you like this, please visit the Practical Ethics channel on YouTube, where you can find more interviews like this.